From KPFK, Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A young mother in New York City died in a city subway in late January. 22-year-old Malaysia Goodson of Stamford, Connecticut, was navigating New York City's notoriously inaccessible subway system with her one-year-old child in a stroller while on the subway steps. She fell down the flight of steps, and while the child miraculously survived, Ms. Goodson did not. Her tragic death has raised the ire of other parents who know intimately the dangers of trying to take the subway with their child in a stroller, and also of disability activists and disabled New Yorkers who for years have fought for a more accessible system of public transportation. We tend to take for granted those design features that are built into structures and city infrastructure that we use on a daily basis, such as street curb ramps or elevators, automatic door openers, and wide doorways. But those design features were not simply dreamt up by forward-thinking city planners and architects on their own. They were the results of hard-won victories by disability rights activists over years. My guest is Bess Williamson. She is an assistant professor of art history, theory, and criticism at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and she's the author of the new book, Accessible America, A History of Disability and Design. Welcome to the program, Bess.
Thanks, Sonali. Hi.
Thanks for joining us. So the story of Malaysia Goodson just so tragically illustrates these design features that that we tend to take for granted, and that when they are missing, we know so intimately and so with such difficulty that that we need them. Did this story for you highlight exactly what it is that you were trying to show in your book?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a horrifying story for anybody, but especially if you've used the New York subway and you're kind of aware of what an intense physical experience it is, right? The kind of the rush of crowds and how many people are like making their way through that subway system, kind of making do, like, you know, the advanced skills that mothers use, parents use to like get their strollers down down the stairs, as well as people, you know, with luggage or carts or whatever. And that this is in a lot of ways sort of understood as like the normal environment until these horrible things happen. But yes, over about a half of a century, right, activists have been calling, and indeed the federal law has required that the subway system become accessible. And the compromises are evident when not every station, you know, includes an elevator. Elevators are poorly maintained or unsafe. And these kinds of issues bring that to attention. And a number of people have been saying, you know, these are issues that disabled activists have been bringing up for decades, you know. Right. Why hasn't it been acted on until now?
So in a way, to sort of summarize, the results of the work that disability rights activists have done for decades is something that we all benefit from, whether or not we live with disabilities, right?
Yes. I mean, you know, there's no amazing architecture that truly serves everybody, of course. But I think certainly the idea, which was articulated as early as the 1970s and 1980s by disability rights activists and architects, of the idea of what we call universal design, right? That what we call accessible or adaptive technologies for disabled people, that category itself is a bit of a falsehood, right? What we consider to be assistive as opposed to what we consider to be the normal environment, changes and fluctuates. And in particular, that when it comes to architecture, when we insert these features, especially when they're designed from the get-go, they tend to open up possibilities for other populations. So, you know, the wheelchair ramp is an obvious one, right? That smooths out a surface for a wide range of populations. The elevator as well, right? In terms of lowering the sort of threshold that it requires for anybody to use these spaces.
So most Americans are familiar with the at least the name. became the Americans for Disabilities Act, ADA. We, you know, have heard of buildings needing to become ADA compliant, but you write in your book that there's a greater history that, of course, went into that and that led up to that particular law. There's the Architectural Barriers Act of 1968, which in the slew of sort of civil rights acts that were signed into law during those years, we often don't think about that particular act. But then even going before that, when did it become in the history of this country, the United States, when did it become apparent to our political leaders that the issue of disability rights and the rights of the disabled was a critical civil rights issue? You go back in your book to all the way to the time when World War II veterans were coming back with serious injuries.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think really what you see is a coming together of a variety of factors, but especially I think a big cultural change in the way that Americans and really people worldwide viewed disability occurred in that mid-20th century moment because of the end of World War II, you know, a highly mechanized war that produced a lot of severe injuries, but also one that, you know, advanced medicine had, you know, improved the survival rate of rather significant injury. But then also the polio epidemic that sort of had its peak in the 1940s and 1950s, in which, you know, so two populations, so the disabled veteran and people with polio, were
who were primarily children, right? But also some adults.
Well, especially, yes, especially in the spotlight were often children, right? Seen as sympathetic and deserving of everything that the society had to offer, right? And so there's a kind of direct connection between these events and the shifting sense that something should be done. That said, as you mentioned, there are sort of these early efforts, but what really puts kind of the fuel behind these efforts, so it makes them real and enforceable, is the language of civil rights. So there's this notion, and literally, you know, a presidential committee wrote in the 1960s, there will be no objection to these measures, right? They can help everyone. Like, who would object to this? But this has actually not been the case, right? There's been quite a lot of objection to the notion of building access. And I think it's really the language of civil rights, which was, you know, again, sort of reaching its sort of apex in the 1960s, that that gave a language to this concern, that it was more than just helping, you know, the poor handicapped, but instead it was a civil right that needed to be protected, even when that was difficult or challenging.
Going back before that, though, we have had a disabled president. How did the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or FDR as he's known, have an impact, if any, on this notion that this is an issue of civil rights? Or, you know, I mean, that was a long time ago.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, of course, right? So FDR is a fascinating case, right? Had a sort of polio-like disease in the 1930s, and then you know, was president, and he used a variety of resources that we would now consider accessible design, right? There was a special ramp that went down to the floor of Congress for him. There's a wheelchair accessible bathroom actually that still exists in the White House.
So the White House was retrofitted with design elements for him.
Slightly. Yeah. Well, we think of as I think of as sort of difficult accessibility. Mm-hmm. He designed his own house back in his hometown in Hyde Park, New York, a little cottage that has like no thresholds and has lower windows so you can see out the window and so on. But these were really personal resources, right? He was a wealthy man. He owned his own rehabilitation center in Georgia, so he sort of, you know, he and the government both fueled this while he was president, but once he was gone, you know, those things disappeared. So there's a real sense in the earlier 20th century, of course, disability has always existed, right, through human history, but it's more this issue that it's a private concern. Like, it's up to you and your family to fix this issue. Otherwise you can't participate. And the sense that sort of to be an American is to like walk by yourself, stand up, you know, stand for yourself as an individual rather than to rely on others. So there's a lot of kind of secrecy involved in this as well.
And shame? And
yes, I mean, I think to some extent, I mean, you know, we think of, you know, the idea that a person is like, you know, cursed or shamed, you know, as being sort of
Yeah, and when I say shame, I mean societal shame, not individual shame about themselves.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there is a sense of kind of hiding away, of a taboo. I mean, right, in some ways, the question of accessibility is who is okay to be seen in public, right? Mm-hmm. To be really included. And sometimes that means, you know, a real challenge to the aesthetic kind of claims that we have, for example, that, you know, a grand building is one that has a beautiful staircase outside of it. So I think there is a sort of sense of invisibility around disability. But I think, you know, this was mitigated to some extent by the figure of like the disabled veteran or children with polio, you know, like who could deny the right of a child with polio, especially a sort of white middle-class child, you know, seen as, you know, promising. And so there's a lot of these kind of overtones of citizenship, right, of sort of inclusion of certain populations, so that there's a kind of gradual move toward a truly public notion of access.
So I'm guessing that the early opposition to universal design was the basis of cost as well. You know, today we have a discussion or debate in this country about who has the right to health care. Medicare for All is the constant argument we're hearing against that is, oh, it would just cost too much. Did you hear those arguments as well in terms of making buildings and infrastructure accessible?
Absolutely, right. So from the very beginning, when the Federal Architectural Barriers Act comes in, there's this like concern, you know, this is going to be inconvenient, this is going to be costly, and it's often presented as a kind of an economic or sort of a statistical argument, you know, like there's only such, you know, small percentage of people who need this, so it's not worth the price. Or even there's this kind of, you know, nobody, like we've never had a disabled employee or a disabled student, so we don't need to build ramps, you know, when of course I think we can recognize there weren't disabled students at many colleges because they couldn't, you know, they couldn't be there, or they knew they couldn't be there.
So it's a circular logic. Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely, a kind of circular logic. But I see, especially in the 1970s and 1980s, when public transportation becomes a key site of debate around access, the argument about cost comes up in particular, and the idea that accessibility is a kind of a luxury that disabled people are asking for, as if they're being asked to be sort of, you know, shuttled from door to door. You know, ironically, actually, disabled people were asking to take the same public transportation as everyone, right? But there's this kind of argument, like everyone else is suffering because they, you know, they're, the subway is closed for renovations because of this special interest, you know? So this contrast is really drawn, I think, especially around public transportation. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of as the true kind of democratic transportation, right? Mm-hmm. The people you see on the bus are the people, you know, that you know, are often the most poor, people who are carrying stuff, people who don't have other options. And this is the site where there's often the most resistance. You know, the mayor of New York City says, this is a ridiculous idea to make the subway accessible. Ed Koch says, you know, we're going to, there'll be 500 people the first day using a wheelchair on the subway, and afterwards, maybe one. So you're saying this is a ridiculous kind of asking too much. Right. Sort of notion.
When in fact, of course, activists were simply asking for a way in which they could be more independent, right, rather than special treatment. And now we know, after many years of society benefiting from that design, that we all do benefit. I mean, whether or not one needs a wheelchair, there have been many of us who have needed to wheel a large suitcase into an airport or a subway station and have been able to take advantage of those hard-fought for design elements. And we're all, by the way, of course, eventually, if we live long enough, we'll age. And as we age, it becomes harder and harder to deal with infrastructure that is not accessible. So let's go back a little bit in history again. We started to talk briefly about the way in which the language of the civil rights movement became a really important tool. Tell us, paint a picture for us of how the disability rights movement, especially in the 60s, came about and what its links were to the civil rights movement. Was it a sort of separate movement that used the language and the momentum of the civil rights movement for racial justice, or were they more intertwined?
There certainly is an intertwining. That said, you know, the disability rights movement in many ways adopted some of the language of the civil rights movement in terms of talking about segregation. There's a kind of famous photograph of a protest where someone's a wheelchair user is holding a sign that says, "I can't even get to the back of the bus," which I think today we might call into question somewhat. Many of the leaders of the disability rights movement were sort of white, educated, particularly wheelchair users, many of them the grown-up children with polio from sort of the 1950s. So you have a particular movement, a kind of epicenter of the disability rights movement in Berkeley, California. So you can imagine Berkeley in the 60s, right? The, you know, a massive protests happening all the time. And there's a group of disabled students, particularly sort of wheelchair users, who were living in a special dorm at the top floor of the campus hospital. And they, you know, started as real sort of individual strivers. They had done a lot to get there, but they start fairly quickly to kind of get connected with the politics of the moment and understand their own situation, not only in terms of their own individual achievement, but sort of what's happening. And so you see sort of more of the discussion of, you know, it's not just about us, but it's about others outside. We're particularly concerned about people who are institutionalized. And so there's a little bit of a sense of, you know, an overall identity. And there in Berkeley, there's a number of really significant moments, including the founding of like a grassroots social service agency rather than, you know, having the government decide, you know, your benefits or what classes you can take or where you can live or something to have a sense of self-determination there, but particularly in terms of the city plan. So the students or some of them were sort of community members in Berkeley. They agitated for the first wheelchair accessible kind of district. So rather than just an individual building or a campus, they pressured the city to build a chain of about 100 wheelchair ramps all in sort of one fell swoop in the early 1970s. And even more significantly than that, they got written into the city's law that for any new developments related to access, disabled communities needed to be consulted. So this is a big design intervention itself, right? Calling not only for like any specific architectural item, like a ramp in this building, right? But saying we need to be asked for this planning, sort of, you know, inserting themselves into the official process for design. And I see that as very akin to other civil rights notions of like seizing the means of control in this moment.
So how did the Architectural Barriers Act of 1968 on a federal level then encompass or at least begin to encompass some of those demands that activists were making for more accessibility in, you know, in many arenas of life?
So there's actually kind of two important federal acts. I appreciate you getting like really wonky on the legislative history here. So there's the Architectural Barriers Act of 1968, which requires that all government buildings incorporate a kind of minimal code. The sort of standard of the time was very basic, but, you know, wheelchair ramps, accessible bathrooms, parking, so it mainly focused around wheelchair access. Very little is actually done. There's no enforcement. So 4 years later, the government found that like 10% of buildings. So you have this law, but it doesn't really push into action. But interestingly, under President Nixon, actually, the 1973 Rehabilitation Act, which was like a government act to fund, you know, rehabilitation programs, has a tiny clause in it called Section 504. And anyone watching who has a child who receives disability services will recognize Section 504 is like the name of their service. But the Section 504 uses civil rights language. It says no one can be discriminated against in government services on the basis of quote unquote handicap. And historians have found that people didn't even really necessarily know what that meant as they wrote it or what the implications of that would be. But the decade that follows, their ongoing arguments about, well, what does that mean to not discriminate? Does that mean that, you know, nobody is actively telling you can't get on the bus, or does the bus need to be accessible? So then, then fast forward to 1977, really nothing has been done once again about that act. And there are nationwide protests by the disability community, including a month-long occupation of the federal building in San Francisco. And that's really what like pushes for specific and enforceable legislation. So you can see it takes a long time and a lot of discussion about, you know, okay, we have this principle, but what does this actually mean in action to bring this about?
And then in 1990 is the Americans for Disabilities Act, the ADA. And I imagine that the ADA also, of course, required a significant amount of effort into it and then a significant amount of enforcement of it, right?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I basically think that, you know, the 1968 Act and the 1973 Act are both about government services. So, you know, and the government is involved in a lot of things, right? College education, you know, public transportation, not to mention just all the offices and services, the post office and so on. But the 1990 Act covers all aspects of what we call public accommodation, so private businesses as well, and a significant sort of increase of employment protection. So, you know, you have the public bus in the 1980s, and then after the ADA, you have the Greyhound bus, right? So it's like when private entities also have to conform to this law after 1990. That said, it also had its enforcement issues. Very few lawsuits still have been really successful under the ADA. It's very difficult to win ADA lawsuits. And my mind is not remembering right now, but there's a second ADA sort of reinforcement act in 2008. So, you know, these laws have to be constantly kind of tailored and reinforced because they tend to get sort of chipped away by the variety of forces. I mean, this is really true for all civil rights protections. There needs to be a kind of constant reshuffling and conversation about who is protected.
So, Bess, you are at the Art Institute of Chicago. Let's spend the last few minutes talking specifically about design, because, you know, we've had, predictably, you have the opposition to these demands made by, legitimate demands made by disability rights activists that it's an inconvenience to make things accessible. But how has design evolved to take those requirements that we need to make life easier for so many Americans and turned that into an aesthetic that is part of a broader cultural shift in the country?
Well, it's so fascinating, right? Because I think the law has, you know, we can critique the law and note the many ways in which there's been sort of resistance and backlash. But nonetheless, we have, you know, a federal law that gives a name to this realm of design and makes it a kind of standard set of standard knowledge that all architects must know. And I think that does a lot. But then there's, you know, I think in the recent decades, there've been a lot of discussion about sort of beyond ramps. Like what other forms of accessibility, if we see the ADA compliance as kind of a baseline, as a very minimum, what else is there? And there's been a lot of really great work recently, I think, especially around, you know, sort of environmental experience that may not be resolvable through a ramp, but particularly with the attention to, you know, sort of neurodiversity and sensory awareness that comes with awareness of autism spectrum disorders and so on, that there's been more of a sense of, you know, spatial use and environment in addition to, you know, these sort of bare minimums of like the width of a doorway and so on. The recent change that I'm seeing, which I'm really excited about, is more and more self-identified disabled people entering into design professions. I mean, this is a real rarity. Design architecture training programs are notoriously very rigorous and demanding, and, you know, just in terms of like staying up all night and being sort of bullied by your professors and so on. And I see a slight, but a cultural change toward considering, you know, who does that culture not include? And that might be people who identify as disabled, right? Who have chronic illnesses or have mobility issues or have sensory differences or just learning differences. So there have been a number of organized efforts to sort of increase the presence of disabled people as designers, right? Not being designed for, but actually participating and creating work on their own, which I think that will make a huge sort of sea change in design culture.
Right. I mean, it's a much more empowering dynamic.
Right. It's sort of getting away from the idea that there's a kind of a norm and then you add on access.
Sure.
Right. If we destroy the idea of a norm, we may start really with something new.
Right. Yeah. If that just becomes part of an underlying aesthetic that informs all design, it makes things so much more different. And these are life and death issues, as that story of Malaysia Goodson that we started our conversation with illustrates. I mean, she's just unfortunately the latest example, and there have been so many others. And I'm finally wondering also if you think that along with this long history of struggle for accessible design, hand in hand with that, has there gone a cultural shift in how disabled Americans are viewed both by themselves and by the nation? A cultural shift. We used to use this term handicapped, which we don't anymore. Now more and more people are saying, using different terms, and this idea of being an ableist is something that, in discriminating against people living with disabilities. We used to say confined to a wheelchair. Now we say wheelchair users. Has that cultural shift gone hand in hand with the shift on design?
Yes, I think so. You know, although there are moments when, you know, there's a kind of a negative response, right? Like this is just a code, right? Rather than truly a sort of culture and identity issue. But I think overall, I mean, as you mentioned, I think there's an overall increasing like kind of cultural literacy around disability, right, that can go hand in hand and alongside our other kind of cultural awareness of difference and contribution in terms of diversity, right, that disability is not a kind of separate tragic experience, but a core experience of being human, right, and that's represented in all cultural groups, you know, like sexual orientation kind of cuts across, you know, class and race and culture, and right, and so to recognize that disability itself is a producer of culture, right, it's not just a sort of a, you know, seen as a kind of negative experience, but that in fact many of the great artworks and design works that we see come out of positions of, you know, of disability, right, of people sort of inventing and discovering alternative ways of making and doing things because it doesn't work for them. So those are areas that I think are really promising from a cultural, you know, really understanding disability as a component of diversity.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Bess, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Bess Williamson is an assistant professor of art history, theory, and criticism at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. We've been discussing her new book, Accessible America, A History of Disability and Design. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.